I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. As lifelong Disney fans, the work of countless talented Disney creatives have shaped our lives.
Now, as the Disney catalog expands, we're taking a journey through film and television to discover if that spark that shaped us as children lives on in adulthood.
Does your favorite Disney media still cast that same spell? Join us as we find out. We are
Rewatching the Magic. Happy Revenge of the Sixth, Kiki.
There is much revenging.
Yes, this is our annual Star Wars episode. A little late for May the 4th, but we are doing it on Revenge of the Sixth. And we are talking Solo, a Star Wars story. A movie that has had a lot of controversy in more ways than one. It's the movie that Disney got the wrong idea, that Disney learned the wrong lesson from, because now they don't want to recast any of the old actors, and now we get deep fake AI voices.
Yeah.
But yeah. So we get, you know, deep fake AI Luke Skywalker in Mandalorian rather than a new actor playing Luke Skywalker, because according to Disney, no one wanted to see anyone else play Han Solo.
I don't think that's true. Can we just jump right into it?
Sure.
It wasn't that we didn't want to see anybody else play Han Solo. I'm just not sure I wanted to see this dude play Han Solo.
It's hard to imagine the way this version, this Han Solo, was written to become the Han Solo that we see in New Hope.
Yeah. And honestly, I hate to say it, but like, who is this dude? It's really weird. Okay, I admit, and we've talked about it before, I have a lot of face blindness. Mm-hmm. I have to be exposed to people either in their work or face to face for quite a long time before their facial features stick. I'm much mm-hmm. better with voices, which is why I like voice acting a lot. But face blindness is kind of, you know, a thing I have to deal with. I have seen this guy in a lot of stuff. Okay? Mm-hmm. I recently saw him in Oppenheimer. Mm-hmm. I have no idea who he was in Oppenheimer. Couldn't tell you. I saw him in Hail Caesar. Good movie. I love a Coen Brothers movie. Could not tell you who he was in that movie. Mm-hmm. Okay? It turns out, looking through his back catalog of work, I have seen him in a lot of stuff. Could not tell you who he was in any of those things except for Solo. And honestly, I don't think he makes a really good Han Solo. There's not a through line, and I think some of it is him. No offense. It's not really an actor's fault when they get miscast. However, I think a lot of it is on the script. And we'll get into that when we talk about the actual plot. Mm-hmm. But there are people who were perfectly cast. Can you imagine anybody else as Lando Calrissian, young Lando Calrissian, other than Donald Glover?
I mean, they were at one point going to do a Lando series with Donald Glover.
Which they should still do. Why are they not doing that? Why am I not watching that right now?
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, missed opportunity. Hello. Mm-hmm. Donald Glover wasn't the only person up for that. Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, who we've seen in the Aquaman movies, And also was Dr. Manhattan in the HBO Watchmen series. Who, I mean, he's a good actor. Don't get me wrong. I like him as an actor. He is also supposed to play Wonder Man if that series ever comes out, which right now, question mark.
Yeah, I mean, the last few months, Marvel and Disney have been saying that they're going to start cutting back on the projects, which, on one hand, I understand there's been a lot of Marvel projects over the last few years, but at the same time, my big fear is they're only going to concentrate on the big characters and not give the lesser-known characters their due.
If they did not focus on lesser-known characters, we wouldn't have an MCU.
Yeah.
Nobody other than deep Marvel fans gave a crap about Iron Man. And that's why we have the MCU. So
it was all X-Men. Yeah, it was all X-Men and Spider-Man back in the 90s.
Yeah. Also, Thor. Thor was a joke until the first Thor movie.
Mm-hmm.
Kenneth Branagh made Thor not a joke. Okay? Let's put respect on that name. So, maybe learn the right lessons here.
Mm-hmm.
Who gave a crap about Moon Knight until he got a TV series?
That's true. I mean, but outside of the hardcore comic fandom.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, normies.
Hmm.
Not us. We're a completely different kettle of fish here. But, yeah, I mean, so, like I said, I'm a fan of the acting talent, but if you're like, do you want to see him as Lando Calrissian, or do you want to see Donald Glover as Lando Calrissian? That's not, you know?
Mm-hmm.
One of the other finalists was O'Shea Jackson Jr., Ice Cube's son, best known as playing his father in the Straight Outta Compton movie. So, do I want to see him play Lando Calrissian? No. Again, no offense to his acting talent, but if it's him or Donald Glover, Donald Glover.
And Donald Glover perfectly encapsulates Billy Dee Williams in his performance.
He's got the cadence of Billy Dee Williams down perfectly. If you close your eyes and listen to the voice, the way he speaks, the intonation. I mean, background on linguistics here. He is perfect in the way he hits the, in linguistics it's called prosody, the kind of musical quality of the way a person talks. And he does that perfectly in the way he has Billy Dee Williams' way of speaking, and I can't imagine anyone else nailing it that way, including the voice actors who do Lando in the various cartoons and video games and stuff.
Some of that is actually Billy Dee Williams.
Well, yeah, I mean, Billy Dee Williams has come back for some of that, but when people do Lando, you know, and try to do their Billy Dee Williams impression, no one has ever nailed it the way Donald Glover does.
Mm.
You believe that is young Billy Dee Williams.
Mm.
So, perfect casting. And then you look at our star of the movie, you know? You know, we ended up with Alden Ehrenreich playing Han Solo, but there were so many famous people that were up for this. Tom Felton, Draco Malfoy.
I can see that actually.
I mean, it's not a bad choice maybe, but they were thinking about Charlie Cox at one point. Daredevil?
Maybe.
I mean, I'm not really for that. At one point, Rami Malek, and I love Rami Malek, but no. Aaron Taylor Johnson, who was Quicksilver in Ultron. I'm thinking no on that one as well. Taron Egerton, maybe.
Eggsy.
Yeah, he might have pulled that one off.
I mean, he pulled off young Elton John. I can see him doing that.
Well, yeah, but also remember, he's Welsh and not English, but you know what I say about, like, we have American actors. Yeah. Can we please use them? Mm-hmm. Speaking of American actors, some of the American actors that were up for it, Ansel Elgort, Dave Franco, who, no, can we not? No. Miles Teller. I'm on the fence about that one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think as much as I'm kind of against going across the pond for American replacements,
mm-hmm.
I think Taron Egerton is maybe, you know, of those.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you feel about it. Like, of the ones we talked about,
if they can play the role, sure. I mean, we get dialect coaches are a thing. I'm okay with it.
But I mean, as far as the Han Solo-ness of it.
I mean, there are people who were saying, well, why not this actor? He looks like Han Solo. He looks like, you know, he looks like Harrison Ford. This actor looks like Harrison Ford, which I understand that you would want an actor that looks like Harrison Ford to play Han Solo, but looks are only half of the performance. You actually have to act. You actually have to get the cadence. You have to get the movements. And the problem with this movie is that you don't get the looks, you don't get the cadence, you don't get the body language of Harrison Ford.
And you also don't really get the charisma, I don't think, of Harrison Ford either.
Mm.
Say what you want about Harrison Ford, and there is stuff to say.
He did not give three Fs about Star Wars.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is that. And he also couldn't get three Fs about Marvel. I mean, you know, he's about to have...
He's our new Thunderbolt Ross.
Thunderbolt Ross, and he's like, yeah, I don't care about this Marvel crap anyway, and whatever.
Sure.
Just give me a paycheck, I don't care. But he is a rather charismatic guy on screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I just really didn't get this from Alden Ehrenreich, you know?
I think that his version of Han Solo is too hopeful. Like, the way they have him growing up, he grows up as an orphan, he grows up in the streets. He is way too hopeful for someone who had that rough an upbringing.
This
and also way too naive.
Oh, so naive. This is 10 years, you know, it's 10 BBY in Star Wars terms. So 10 years before A New Hope. And we're we're seeing him almost unrecognizable. Which is weird because he should already start having some of that edge.
Yeah. He should already be a smuggler.
Well, I don't think we necessarily have to see him already a smuggler. He's... So on Corellia, he is basically Oliver Twist. You know what I mean? Like, he's one of those orphan kids that's just taken in by the alien version of Fagin.
And you said Oliver Twist. Like, he's playing Oliver Twist, but he should be acting like Dodger.
Kind of, you know. He's... But, you know, the alien woman that's there, who, by the way, can we have a... I need to give a shout out to Linda Hunt playing Lady Proxima here. They should have used her more, but it's a nice little cameo. I absolutely adore Linda Hunt. We talked about her, I think, before when we talked about Pocahontas, because she's also in that. She is Grandmother Willow in that, so I know we talked about her at least in that. But does a lot of voice work. We've talked about her in, you know, lots of things here and there. But she shows up just very briefly to voice Lady Proxima before Han burns her with sunlight. Ruthless. Which does seem like a Han Solo thing to do.
Yeah.
You start out and you're like, okay, that's, yeah. Yeah, go Han. But, you know, she's kind of the Fagin to his, you know, either Oliver or Dodger, you know, however you want to see him. But he is just a low-level orphan gangster. Mm. You know, he gets sent out on, you know, go steal this and bring it back for Lady Proxima and her group of orphan kids. And that should make him... a little, you know, he's got that dream of, like, you know, one day I'm gonna steal enough money to get off this planet.
You and me, Kira, we're gonna get our own ship, we're gonna get out of here, and we're gonna live happily ever after.
Yeah, because he's in love with Kira, and, you know, they're both under the, you know, under the, thumb or whatever of Lady Proxima.
She doesn't have a thumb.
Yeah, I said or whatever. But they're, you know, Han steals from her, you know, some hyperfuel, and they try to get away, and Kira gets captured, and Han ends up joining the Empire. So that he can learn to fly, so that he can get a ship and come back and get Kira.
And I want to pause here for a moment, since we're at that part of the movie. That entire opening part of the movie, because I think it's time we talked about the other controversy with this movie. And that's Phil Lord and Christopher Miller, who were the original directors of this movie. That opening scene, all of them. It was their idea because they wanted to have the movie open with an action scene. And they felt that this scene would perfectly set up the characters in the movie. And honestly, I think they did a good job in that. Big question is, they were fired from this job. They had directed a good chunk of the movie. And then they were fired. Here's the thing about, like, you know, like, when it came to these new Star Wars movies, especially when they decided that they were going to make anthology movies, they wanted each of these anthology movies to have their own voice and have a unique director and unique writers. And so, you know, like, we would get, you know, Gareth Edwards and Tony Gilroy for Rogue One, and we would get Rian Johnson for The Last Jedi, et cetera, et cetera. So unique voices to make these movies unique to their own. And Lord and Miller mostly are known for comedies.
They did the Lego movie.
21 Jump Street. Like,
they did the Lego movie, which is a good movie.
Yes, but one of the things was people were kind of wondering, another person that the fan casting, not people who actually auditioned for the movie, Chris Pratt, people were fan casting Chris Pratt to be Han Solo. Again, this is years before Chris Pratt was in everything.
No worst Chris. No.
But
I'll take the dude we got over worst Chris any day.
Mm-hmm. But also, you know, of course, the Spider-Verse movies. And that's all good. And Lord and Miller, really known as comedy, and they really wanted this to be more of a comedy movie. And there's a lot of scenes in this movie that really feel, okay, this is a Lord and Miller scene.
That bit where he takes the speeder and he tries to turn it sideways and then they get stuck and he's like, well, crap, run, you know? Mm-hmm. I love that bit. It's very Han Solo. It's very, you know, if you go back into New Hope and it's like, you know, don't tell me what to do, princess. Crap, I screwed up. You know, it's that same vibe. That feels like Han Solo to me.
Yeah. So that kind of feels like a Lord and Miller move. Problem is, and we kind of hear the stories now over how Across the Spider-Verse was done, how Lord and Miller were having animators stay longer hours, how they had animators fully animate scenes before they decided to cut them, and stuff like that. With this movie, they were staying longer hours. Budget was getting bigger. They were getting delayed. Also, and the big one, at least that certain people didn't like, Lord and Miller is very into improvisation in their movies. And apparently encouraged the actors to improv in the movies, which apparently was not appreciated by the writers of this movie, Lawrence Kasdan and his son Jonathan. Lawrence Kasdan, you might know him. He is co-writer on Empire Strikes Back and Return of Jedi and Force Awakens and Raiders of the Lost Ark. So you know his work. So for him to... So apparently he was not very, very keen on the ad-libbing that was going on with this movie. But again, like I said, this movie was also going behind schedule and a bit over budget, which this Disney steps in. Okay, Lord and Miller, you're out. Enter Ron Howard, who reshoots everything that Lord and Miller did so he can get sole directing credit.
Kind of a douche move.
Kind of, but I get it.
I mean, I get it, but kind of a douche move.
Yeah.
No offense to Ron Howard, who we have talked about before, and we both have great respect for.
great director.
Yeah.
But yeah, most of the comedy bits in here were Lord and Miller's additions to the script and were kept in by, apparently Ron Howard agreed with those decisions because he kept them in his reshoots. And you know, it's a Ron Howard movie because Clint Howard has a cameo in the movie.
Which I am always fine with.
Yeah.
I mean, go Clint Howard.
One of the few times nepotism works.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, we do get Bryce Dallas Howard. We've talked about before, you know, working on Star Wars now in some of the TV series. And she has been directing some of the episodes and she's done a really good job of it. Mm-hmm. So again, maybe nepotism works in that case as well, because I've enjoyed her directing work on that. So it seems that she learned a lot from her father.
One of the big changes from Howard's version, from the Lord and Miller version, was the character of Dryden Voss, our big villain. Originally, in the Lord and Miller film's footage, played by Michael K. Williams in a mocap suit, and it was going to be replaced with a CGI alien, a kind of a mountain lion-looking alien. For the reshoots, Howard brought in Vision himself, Paul Bettany, and just had him be a human character. So apparently Michael Williams was unavailable for the reshoots, so they just decided to refilm all the scenes with Paul Bettany.
I mean, once again, no offense to Michael K. Williams, excellent actor.
Mm-hmm.
I love Paul Bettany in this role. I love Paul Bettany in any role. I mean, we've talked about it before. I still have trouble remembering that Paul Bettany's name is not Naked Chaucer. Because that's just what we called him until he became Vision.
Mm-hmm.
My entire friend group just knew him as Naked Chaucer. Because that was the role that, like, everybody in my friend group knew him for. From Knight's Tale. It's just like, that's his first scene in Knight's Tale, is just him standing there naked as Chaucer.
Mm-hmm.
So we had no idea what his name was, because he was just the guy who played Naked Chaucer. And I don't think we knew him from anything else until he became Vision. No offense to Paul Bettany, who is an excellent actor and I love, but for like 15 years, that is the only role that my friend group knew him for. And then we would see him in other things and we'd be like, hey, is that Naked Chaucer?
Technically, he's still naked as a Vision.
Well, yeah, I mean, Vision is technically always naked, but yeah. It is kind of funny now that I am just now like 20 years into knowing him as an actor, finally learning his real name. But yeah, I really like what they did with the character. I don't know how it would have worked as like weird CGI mountain lion or whatever.
Hmm.
And we will probably never see that other footage.
Yeah.
Which is kind of sad, so I can't really compare. But I absolutely love Voss as a character because Paul Bettany is so evil.
So cold. And like, it's not even I have a point kind of villain. It is, and it's not even mwahaha mustache twirling evil. It's like, I am a businessman. My business is crime. You mess with my business, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah, I mean, he's very easy to understand. And he's just ruthless in that very capitalist sort of way, you know? Mm. There is the traditional idea of the villain always sees themselves as the good guy. But I kind of like the subversion of in this movie that he doesn't see himself as the good guy. He knows that he does awful things and he does not care.
Yeah, and we find that Drayden Voss is the public face of a criminal organization known as Crimson Dawn, the public face during the Empire years, because, well, the real head of Crimson Dawn cannot show his face in public. Let's rip that
Because
Band-Aid
he's
off.
dead.
He's not dead.
He's dead.
He's got metal legs. It's somehow Darth Maul returned.
This movie made me feel like I was insane. We got to talk about this.
So we got Ray Park back as Darth Maul with Sam Witwer doing the voice. He the same person who does the voice for the Clone Wars cartoon for Star Wars Rebels. This is bringing the Star Wars animated cartoons canon to the live action projects.
Justice for Peter Serafinowicz, who did record all the lines and then was recorded over by Sam Witwer.
Probably because the audience that this is aiming to will probably be more familiar with his voice in Clone Wars.
This movie made me feel like I was losing my damn mind.
Yeah, when we talked way back when we talked last year when we talked about the Clone Wars cartoons, you were like, the Clone Wars cartoons are in canon. Stop making these cartoons canon, and they're canon.
I'm just, drives me absolutely nuts. When I saw this movie, I think you were the first person I contacted. I think I was like riding in the car on the way home from the theater.
And I was watching it in the theater with a bunch of friends because that was, we were at a convention. We were all together at a convention. And this movie had come out, and we went to go all to go see it. And that was a big gasp when Darth Maul showed up at the end of the movie, metal legs and all. Then I get out of the theater, and there's a text from you.
And I was like, when the hell does this movie take place? Because Han Solo is not that much older than Luke and Leia. Like, he's older than Luke and Leia, but he's not that much older than Luke and Leia. Because I'm like, Darth Maul is in this thing and he's still alive, which means this has to take place before Phantom Menace. I was so confused. I'm like, this has to take place before Phantom Menace, but the Empire is in this, so it can't take place before Phantom Menace. But Darth Maul is in this, and Darth Maul is very, very dead. So how does the Empire exist before Phantom Menace? And also, Darth Maul is in. None of this makes sense. Who screwed up this timeline this badly? And then you were like, oh, it's in the cartoons. And I'm like, F the cartoons. The cartoons aren't canon. And you were like, well, yeah, they are. And I'm like, no, they're not. I will myrtleate anybody who says these cartoons are canon.
Well, his name is Dave Filoni, and he wears a hat. He wears a cowboy
Yeah,
hat.
no, and I'm fine with that. Bring me the head of Dave Filoni. I need you to stop. I need you to stop, Dave Filoni. Just stop, Dave Filoni.
Even after we did two episodes on the Clone Wars and one
Yes,
episode on Rebels.
no, just stop, Dave Filoni. That's like, I mean, we're not talking about like a Zaslav situation here, but maybe stop Dave Filoni from doing the thing.
And a whole Ahsoka series that's a sequel to Rebels.
Which was not really a great series. We'll get into that maybe at some point, but no. I said what I said. You can come at me on social media all you want. I'm easy to find.
So, yeah, And also part of Crimson Dawn is Han's little girlfriend, Kira, played here by Emilia Clarke. And before we started recording, we were talking about other actors who were considered for the role of Kira.
I think one of the most interesting things about this movie is all the other people that might have been in this movie. I mean, am I wrong about that? Because we were talking a little bit about it off mic.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, so, you know, we've already talked about who might have been Han Solo, who might have been Lando Calrissian. Who might have been Kira includes Tessa Thompson, which I think I would have loved, because mm-hmm. I am a total stan for Tessa Thompson. I mean, we've talked about that before when we've talked about Thor things.
Mm-hmm.
Zoe Kravitz was another one. Which might have been interesting.
Jessica Henwick from Iron Fist.
Yeah. Interestingly, another Game of Thrones person. She was Nymeria Sand.
It's really weird that the character of Kira was based off who they were originally going to cast for this movie, was apparently supposed to be a person of color.
Yeah. One of the things is that somebody who did later end up in Star Wars, the woman who played Bix Killeen in Andor, she was originally up for the part of Kira. She also was Anathema Device in Good Omens. Yay. But yeah, I mean, there were a lot of interesting things, and then they went with Emilia Clarke, who I love as an actor, you know. The thing is that for the most part, the actors they went with, all really good actors, but it's very interesting to consider who, you know, alternate castings on this. Like, we were also talking about that the Woody Harrelson part was originally supposed to go to Christian Bale, which would have been very interesting and a totally different vibe.
I just find it funny that there are these projects for these Star Wars movies, and they always end up with the white English actor, because you have Emilia Clarke, you got Felicity Jones, and you get Daisy Ridley.
Yeah. And the thing is that a lot of
actors. I'm not gonna deny any of those three. It's just now that I'm actually thinking about it, I've noticed a pattern.
Yeah, it's like they had a bunch of people in contention. It's really interesting that almost all of the other people who were up for the part of Kira were people of color, except for Emilia Clarke.
Yeah, black women,
like pretty
Puerto
much
Rican women,
everybody.
Asian.
Yeah, pretty much everybody on the list was, you know, black, Asian, Latina, you know, some person of color, and then Emilia Clarke, who is, like, pretty much straight down the line, white English actress. Which I don't know what, you know, like I said, I love her. I adore her as an actress. And she does an excellent part in this. But it's just really interesting that when it came down to the short list, it was like eight actresses of color and Emilia Clarke.
Could it have just been because she was like the recognizable face of the most popular TV show of the time?
I'm really hoping it was that. I'm really hoping it was that.
Because people tend to forget how big Game of Thrones was at this time.
Yeah, I think this was before the final season dropped.
Yeah.
And we all collectively wiped Game of Thrones from our memory. We do get Tandoi Newton in here, speaking of actresses of color.
As Val Beckett, which is Tobias's wife.
Some sort of partner. I don't know if they're actually married, but you
both
know.
They both have the last name Beckett, so...
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, all right then.
Romantic interest. We'll go with that.
Yeah, I mean, well, whatever they are to each other, but I mean, it's very, you know.
They're very close in this movie. The two characters are.
I really love Val, and I really hate that it's like, yay, she's here, and now she's dead.
Yeah, because she comes up as a very interesting character. And then all of a sudden, a few scenes later, it's, we're not going to get out of here alive. It's been a hell of a ride, babe. Boom.
Yeah, it does. Her death does seem really pointless. Like, especially when she's pinned down by some droids, but like, really? That's the only way out?
All of Tobias's crew dies in this heist that they end up losing.
Yeah, he's left with just Han and Chewie.
Let's talk Chewie.
Yeah, here played by Yunus Swatmo, who is now the go-to for Wookiees. He is going to be the first Wookiee Jedi in The Acolyte.
Hmm.
He took over for as the body double for Peter Mayhew in the Force Awakens and Last Jedi because Peter Mayhew, before his death, had started having, you know, due to his height and all that, had started having massive problems with his hips and his spine and things like that. So he wasn't able to do the more active part of Chewie, you know, the running and the stunts and stuff. So they got Yunus to come in and do the more active parts. He was a professional basketball player in Finland. And so he's very athletic. And now that Peter Mayhew has passed on, he is the go-to Wookiee. So he has taken over playing Chewbacca. And also now, I don't know the name of the character off the top of my head. They have released the character's name, I believe. But there will be a Wookiee Jedi for the first time in the upcoming show, The Acolyte, and he will be playing that character. So yeah, we finally see how in canon, now that the EU is erased.
Yeah, that was one of my big
Raz of Fragon.
Yeah, I'll admit the Han Solo book trilogy where you get his young life, I actually did like those. And that this
Me
movie
too.
Kind of the young Han Solo adventures, and then we get this. It feels like this. The entire whole thing of Han Solo before he meets Luke feels like it needed to be more than one movie. But they combined it all into one movie because that's what's part of their anthology plan.
I mean, if they're going to bring in things like, you know, Heir to the Empire and stuff like that, could we not take some of the better parts from, you know, like Han Solo's backstory and stuff like that?
Mm.
Aren't there things that we could pull from the old EU and bring them in? Throw a little bit of money at the people who, like, spent entire lifetimes creating really good backstories for these characters. under the guise of you are writing Star Wars canon. No, oops, you're not. Like, those stories were excellent and well thought out and really, really tied together in good ways. And now it's just like, yeah, we feel like just doing whatever. And I'm like, just go through the back catalog and be like, this is a really good idea. Let's port this over. You know, you got like, you know, 30 years of back catalog. Use it. What the hell is wrong with you people? Anyway.
We get
a new backstory for how Han and Chewbacca met.
I did like that we actually got Han speaking Wookiee, although broken Wookiee.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. That was the one part of that scene I did like. The idea of that the Empire had captured Chewbacca and was using him to kill and perhaps eat deserters or other people. Also, can we point out the thing that gets Han thrown in the pit, which is that he points out that the Empire are the bad guys?
Yeah.
Go, Han.
He even says he got kicked out of the academy for pointing this out, joins the military unit, and is about to rat out Tobias for being, you know, you're not actually the sergeant. There's bullet holes in your uniform. You took it off a dead man. I'm going to call you out. And then Tobias goes, you know what? No, I'm going to call you out.
Well, I was talking more about the scene where, you know, the commander or whatever is telling them, like, hey, we need guys to do this. And Han's like, why are we here? And it's like, well, we're bringing peace and stability to the galaxy, and we're defeating the enemy. And Han says, like, well, actually, this is their planet, and we showed up on it. We're actually the bad guys here.
Yeah, we're protecting from invaders, but we're the invaders.
Yeah, which also I like, because this was previously on an episode of Futurama. I like that this is Star Wars just repeating Futurama.
Well, again, Lord and Miller's original plan was to make this a more comedic movie, so I can see them borrowing from the best, quote-quote.
Well, I mean, it is the best. I mean, Futurama is the best. And now owned by Disney. But the thing is that it's kind of hilarious because, you know, that Futurama episode where Fry and Bender and then Leela end up in the military and they discover that the Earth military is the one that showed up on the planet of the bouncing balls and are the invaders. And Fry is like, wait, we're the bad guys here? And is really surprised that they're the ones that just showed up in a Imperial action, you know? And that's what the Empire is. That's what George Lucas always intended it to be. You know? It is an empire in the truest sense of the word. They go around and they take over other places. And we see Han experiencing that firsthand as a member of the Imperial military. And he doesn't buy into the propaganda. He understands that the Empire has shown up to this planet and they are taking it over. It is imperialism in the dictionary definition of the word, which I like. good part of the movie. Go movie. Yay. Clap, clap.
And I do like that, you know, Chewie goes through his whole story and Han tries to translate it, but he's not, again, like I said, he doesn't speak fluent Wookiee. It's broken Wookiee. So some of the words he has a hard time translating. And basically the thing is that the Empire kidnapped his family and he wants to find his family.
And I like that there's an idea of he's either saying family or tribe, and the question comes up, what's the difference?
So this movie is very much found family is family.
Yeah, which I like, because that is kind of what Star Wars is about.
Yeah.
In some respects, you know, it's... If it was just about your birth family, then we'd have Luke joining Vader. But it's not. It's about the found family. And yeah, okay, you can say, like, Luke and Leia are brother and sister.
He didn't know that.
But he didn't know that, and he chose her anyway. You know?
He left his Jedi training because his found family was in danger.
Because Han was in danger, because, you know, Lando was in danger, because, yeah. Mm-hmm. Star Wars has always been about, you know, forging alliances among people who are different. Mm-hmm. And Han and Chewie become family. Because, you know, and it's weird to bring up the Star Wars holiday special, but...
I was thinking it!
Yeah, you were thinking it, weren't you? Like, Han is part of Chewie's family. He goes and spends the holidays with Chewie's family. Now, you could say, like, well, it's because Han doesn't have a family, but lots of people don't have families and aren't invited to other people's holiday stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, like... Come on, he's invited to come spend the most important holiday on Kashyyyk with Chewie's family. That's family.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you think that that's where this is going, that we're going to get the found family of outcasts and rebels and orphans, and then everything goes topsy-turvy, the heist goes wrong, everybody dies, and then Beckett ends up going Stone Cold Steve Austin, don't trust anybody on Han.
Oh, and can we mention Jon Favreau?
Yeah.
I'm so mad that Jon Favreau died. That is that Rio Durant character. I love that character so much, and I'm so mad that he died. Why did that character have to die? Why did Val have to die? I mean, I think Val got fridged. I consider that a fridging. I don't know if you do, but I do.
I don't know. Tobias Beckett's character feels like, yes, that is his partner, and he did feel bad when she died, but it feels like character-wise, it was only a matter of time before he dropped her anyway. If the score was more important than her life, if he was going to make more money off anything else over her, he would have taken it. At least that's how the movie is to let us believe. At least later on, after all this has happened.
I mean, maybe. Yeah. But I don't know. At the time, every time I watch that scene, it just feels like such a pointless fridging to me. Because there are almost no women in this thing, and except for the only one that gets, like, actual screen time that lives is Kira. I mean, Enfys Nest lives, but she gets almost no screen time, and for most of the movie is misgendered as a he, because that is the, like, bum, 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 you know? Mm-hmm. It's a girl. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, Enfys Nest is called he for the entire movie until she removes her mask.
Mm-hmm.
And every other female-identified character, except for Enfys Nest and Kira, is killed. And there aren't that many. No. Like, Val is killed, L3 is killed.
I want to talk about L3.
Oh, we are gonna talk about L3. I wanted to do this movie just to talk about L3.
But finish your thought, I'm sorry.
Yeah. But... yeah, I mean, Lady Proxima, even though she's not a good guy, like, is she dead? Does she have, like, I mean, the last time we see her, she's really injured. You know? And Kira, the last time we see her, is like, sorry, I'm a bitch. I'm leaving. You know?
I'm so going to take this opportunity to up my station and get closer to Maul.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, really, the only good woman who lives is Enfys Nest, and she gets very little screen time. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, every other woman is either dead or evil.
Yeah.
Except for Enfys Nest, who, like I said, gets almost no screen time and is misgendered for most of the movie. So, that, I don't know, it's really... you know, they talk about if you put together, like, every line spoken by a woman in New Hope, it's like a minute and a half long or something. This kind of feels like that, you know?
Yeah.
Which kind of annoys me. But yeah. We never finished talking about Han and Chewbacca's meeting. I like that Han and Chewbacca immediately run a con. Like, that's their first thing together.
Yeah.
Is that Han notices that the pipe that they're attached to is a little, you know, wobbly. And he's like, hey, pretend to beat me up. And we'll take down the pipe that they're standing on and wing it out of here. And Chewbacca's like, okay, I'm down. You know.
The great fight of pretend. I love how he says that in Broken Wookiee.
But it's a good thing, you know, like we will do the pretend, and Chewbacca's like, yeah, okay.
Your sounds Wookiee's like a bit off, but I get it.
But see, this is why you should learn other languages, even if they're broken.
Mm-hmm.
People will respect you if you at least try to learn their language.
And I do like how that's how their friendship starts. He just starts speaking Wookiee to him. Oh, you can speak Wookiee. Yeah, I can speak Wookiee.
And I like that one of the first things he does is like kind of insult Chewbacca in Wookiee, in Broken Wookiee.
It feels like that's like the first thing he probably learned in Wookiee.
Yeah.
But yeah, the you know, that's how it starts. The friendship between Han and Chewie. So let's backtrack one, because I really want to talk about L3. L337.
Leet.
This is a Lord and Miller joke. This is a Lord and Miller joke because they have a droid named Leet.
Yeah, and I can't imagine Ron Howard putting that joke in.
Yeah.
And she is Leet. She is voiced by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, Fleabag herself.
Mm-hmm.
And I love this character, and I hate what they did to her.
So they introduce... how would I explain this? I'm trying to be kind. They have her... It feels, again, this was clearly written by a man because they kind of have her as the sort of feminist droid rights activist character.
Yeah, the thing is it feels like somebody heard the discourse among the fandom about droid rights and the fact that droids in Star Wars are sentient and yet kept as basically slaves.
We don't serve your kind here.
Which we have talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about how they did it so well in Andor with B2 Emo.
Mm-hmm.
And how Marva and Cassian and basically everybody connected to that, to the Andor family, treated B2 as basically part of the family. And
by the time at the end of that series, when B2 is thrown out, is thrown by one of the Imperials, you're like, whoa, is B2 okay?
The Imperial hits B2, like the entire town is like, how dare? No. Screw the Empire. Beat up that Imperial. He hit B2.
And the fact that that's kind of treated in this movie as a joke.
Yeah, when we first see L3, she walks into the droid gladiator thing that Clint Howard is running and is trying to tell the combatants, like, stop fighting each other. Why are you risking your lives for humanoid entertainment? They don't care if you live or die. And honestly, she has a point. What is in it for the droids? Are they getting a cut of the profit? Like, a boxer has the consent to go into a ring and risk their health. They get a cut of the profit. You know? Hmm. They can say yes or no to a fight, theoretically. You know? It is a sport. They sign a contract, they get compensation. Presumably, the droids are not being compensated in that way. They have no rights. She is correct on an ethical level. If you consider a sentient being to be worthy of freedom, most droids in Star Wars are known to be sentient.
Mm-hmm.
So she is correct in her statement. And it is treated as a joke. Lando kind of rolls his eyes and he's like, oh, L3 is at it again, you know. But the thing is that she is kind of proven right later on. When they get to Kessel,
she starts a riot.
I mean, bravo her. She looks and she says, she tries to communicate with another droid, and the droid is incapable of communicating with her, and she realizes it has a restraining bolt. Which is why we now understand what was happening to R2 in A New Hope when 3PO says the thing about the restraining bolt. They don't just, like, prevent a droid from leaving an area, which is what we always kind of thought. That, like, R2 was, like, running a con. But it seems like restraining bolts actually, like, prohibit droids sometimes from actually having thought. Which is cruel. It's like droid lobotomy.
Yeah.
And once she removes the restraining bolt, the droid is like, oh my god, I have my brain back. What do I do? And she's like, go free your other droids. And the droid is like, freedom! And as soon as the other droids are free, they choose to start the riot. L3 actually doesn't tell them to do that. She tells the first droid, like, go remove the restraining bolts. And then the droids themselves are like, screw this place and everyone in it. Riot. Free the prisoners. Kill the guards. That's not L3's doing. It takes, like, more than one viewing of the movie, I think, to really understand that. But L3 does not tell them to do that. That is a choice made by the droids that were there on site.
Mm-hmm.
L3 is just focused on the task of helping Han and Chewie do the mission. The droids are the ones who start the riot and start freeing prisoners and telling the prisoners, like, hey, take over the place, kill the guards, freedom, whatever. And in fact, the stuff that the droids do actually kind of hurts the mission a little bit.
It causes L3's death.
Well, yeah, I mean, eventually it does cause L3's death, but I'm talking about before that, like when they're all just in the control room. It makes it a little more difficult for Han and Chewie because the riot starts going on around them, and it makes it a little more difficult for them to get where they're going. But that's not really L3's doing. She just removed the restraining bolt to get the droid to move.
Mm-hmm.
And then it starts a chain reaction because once the droids are free, they make that choice on their own. Which really, I think, tells you a lot. But the fact that it's portrayed in the movie as L3 starts a riot for comedy purposes, I think is a really weird misunderstanding and misreading of what actually happens in the film.
But that comes from earlier in the film where Lando's asking L3, hey, L3, do you want anything? Equal rights? Ugh.
I hate that line. I really do. It's one of the worst lines in the film.
And of course, there's that girl-to-girl conversation where L3 and Kira said, oh yeah, Lando's in love with me. I thought about it, but no.
But the thing is I don't think she's wrong.
Especially with the way Lando reacts when L3 is shot.
He risks his own life. Which is not something you do for property.
If not in love, he definitely cares for L3 and values her.
Well, here's the thing. Everybody knows it, and Donald Glover has also said it. Lando is the Star Wars version of pansexual. And I mean pan in the really overarching sense, not just irrespective of gender, but
species.
Without respect to species, and I do think that also means droid. I think if a droid consented, I do think that Lando cares about consent. I don't think that Lando would go around hiring slaves in that sense. I don't think Lando would be a slaver.
Well, at some point, he does become a high-ranking person at Cloud City. So, maybe you're onto something.
Yeah. But I think that if a droid consented to doing something with him and was one of the droids that we know to be sentient, because I do think there are different types of droids, and I do not think all of them are sentient. I think Lando would be down for it. And the fact is, L3, you know, when Kira says, but how would that work? L3 is like, oh, it would work. So there is apparently a way for droids and humans to get it on.
Well, she does say that she thought about it.
Yeah. And
so she's considered the idea of having a relationship with Lando, but probably she would want a relationship with another droid.
Yeah, and I think that would be fine. But I think that if Lando considered her property and was in love with her, he would have tried to force that. And the fact that he hasn't, I think, proves that he does not consider her property.
Especially, okay, you know, L3 is shot. He tries to drag her body. Her body crumbles in his arms. And he's carrying her torso and her head in his arms as he's getting shot. And then the big decision he has to make, does he sacrifice L3's processor for the Falcon to get out of there?
And this is the thing that I really hate. I mean, I hate it more than anything else, I think, in this movie. Which makes it sound like I hate this movie. I do not. Okay, well, we'll get into that more later. But I hate this decision.
It's not L3's decision.
Yeah, we go through the whole thing of L3 being a freedom fighter, L3 wanting equality, L3 wanting to make her own decisions.
Freedom.
And instead, she becomes basically enslaved to the Falcon for eternity.
She's part of the ship now. All to make sense of a throwaway line.
Sir, I don't know where your ship learned to communicate, but it has the most peculiar dialect.
And the weird dialect is probably help me end my suffering.
Because, like, if it was a situation where L3 still had function and said, Lando, we need to get out of here. You need me, but I can't help you. Take my processor and make it part of the ship. If it was L3's decision, it would have been a better ending. But because it's not her decision, and it's a decision that Lando has to make that he has very hard trouble trying to do, He is contemplating this idea. He doesn't know if he doesn't do it, they'll die. But if he doesn't do it, L3 is gone. If they don't do it, they'll die.
If they'd have just added in a tiny scene where he's like, no, we'll get out of here and I can fix your processor and put you in a new body. You know, because that is the one good thing about droids. Mm-hmm. You know, and she says, no, I know this area. You won't get out of here without me. You know, and she says, I care for you, Lando, or I want you to live, or, you know, carry on the fight without me or something, you know. Mm-hmm. If they made it her choice to save Lando, I'm okay with it at that point.
If it would have been a nice thing as like, Lando, what, I love you too, do it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe not even like love, but respect, and she wants him to live, you know, and he promises like, you know, I'll fight for droids or something, you know?
Like, because when L3 shuts down, that caress that Lando does to L3's face, like, that is not someone who views this droid as property.
And that is the thing of, like, if you understand why both Han and Lando are so attached to this ship, it's because that it has, for lack of a better term, the soul of someone who gave themselves to save them. It's not just a ship, it's actually a personality of someone they care for. You know? Mm. Someone who basically gave up their life and their freedom in order to save them. They have an obligation to keep this ship running, to keep this ship safe, because it has L3 in it. This is L3's body now. It's not the Millennium Falcon, it's L3. That would make so much more sense if it was a noble and willing sacrifice. And it would explain why these two men are so endeared to this hunk of junk ship, you know?
Yeah. The garbage will do.
And I would have preferred that, but the way that they do it, it's you take a freedom fighter and you've enslaved her. You take a freedom fighter we've made fun of the entire movie, and now you've enslaved her. And I dislike that to my very core. Because L3, I think, is one of my favorite characters they've ever put into Star Wars, and I think she was treated absolutely abominably.
Maybe, dear listener, you might have a different opinion on it, but, you know, like, I think that's our opinion here.
Yeah, and it feels to me like they were mocking the fan discourse about, you know, Star Wars has always been really weird about the idea of slavery.
One of the major characters was born into slavery.
And the Jedi, who are supposed to be the ultimate good in the galaxy, take him and just leave his mom there to be a slave. Like, they don't even buy her out of slavery.
Nope, we can only buy one of you. Bring the boy.
They don't go back for her later and buy her out of slavery?
Nope, you can't have
They don't send a mercenary to go back and just buy her freedom and let her just live and be like, hey, I know we took you and we're raising you in a cult now where we don't let you have any emotional ties, but just so you know, your mom is free. You know?
Yeah.
Like, maybe he wouldn't have turned to the dark side if they had been like, sorry we took you away from your mom, but we did buy her freedom and we set her up on like a little farm somewhere.
And one thing I did like, and the Clone Wars cartoon actually does address that, the Jedi just let slavery happen in the universe. There are planets where slavery is legal. Anakin tries to make sure that doesn't happen, and here he's told, no, that is the way. That is not our responsibility, is to end slavery in the universe. Our responsibility is to protect the Republic. And of course, the slave that was his entire life ends up becoming a slave to the dark side in a suit where he can never touch anything ever again. Because his freaking arms and legs got cut off.
Because somebody else had the high ground.
Yep.
So Let's talk about the you can't trust anybody portion of this film, because that's the other thing. I don't know. So we got Woody Harrelson in here, who, I mean, he's good as the, I don't know if he's the primary bad guy or the secondary bad guy. There's a few bad guys in here.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he's the smuggler that is the mentor here for Han once he leaves the Imperial forces and is a deserter and whatever. But the thing is that one of the things that Tobias tells Han is don't trust anybody. And then, of course, the completely like, oh, I'm shocked. No, really, I'm very, very shocked. At the end of the movie is, well, of course, the person Tobias was saying you shouldn't trust was him. Because Han has a soft spot for Infus Nest, who we think is supposed to be the bad guy. You know, oh no, they're pirates. It's pirates in space. They're going to steal all of our stuff, and then Voss is going to be mad at us and kill us all and whatever. And then you find out that Infus Nest is basically... What's so funny is, like, I wasn't sure what the big reveal was supposed to be about Infus Nest. Like, was it that she was a woman, or was it that she was, like...
A kid, almost.
A kid, or whatever. Like, I... Here's the problem, is that part of my face blindness is that I have a real trouble telling ages of people. It's kind of like child, teenager to like 25, and then it's like 30 to like 50s, and then it's just like... you know, 50 to like 70, and then like 70 to death or whatever, you know, like my brain is very wibbly about ages. Especially in Hollywood when everybody's like constantly having work done and, you know, really good makeup and stuff and everything's kind of covered over, you know? So like, I don't know how old Erin Kellyman was when she did this movie. So I don't really know how old Infus Nest is supposed to be.
She was about 20, so she was born in 98.
So, but the thing is like, is the character supposed to be 20? Or is it supposed to be like 20 playing 14? Or, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, but I wasn't sure. She says she took over from her mother, and her mother used to wear the mask, which always makes me wonder, like, I don't know if Infus Nest is, like, her name or her title. But if she took over from her mother, why does Tobias keep misgendering her?
It's possible that they've never seen any of that group without their masks on. So just by default, they think they're all men.
Yeah, I don't know. I love that Warwick Davis is part of this group. Yay.
Yep. Yay.
Cameo. Not a Star Wars movie anymore without Warwick Davis in it. We forgot to shout out Anthony Daniels, who has a very brief vocal cameo as the droid that gets whacked during the speeder chase at the beginning of the... You cannot come through here without proper authorization. You know, that one is Anthony Daniels. Love him. He is a wonderful guy. I've talked about meeting him and talking to him before. Such an amazing man. Bless him. I was never sure if we were supposed to be like, it's a woman, or if it was supposed to be like, it's a tiny child.
That's the implication I got watching this movie. Oh, this is a kid. So Crimson Dawn has taken over this world. They've enslaved the people. They've cut their tongues out so they don't speak.
It's possibly Voss himself.
Yeah.
It's a little iffy on whether or not Voss himself is the bad guy who did it, but it's definitely Crimson Dawn. This is when Han starts going like, oh, here I am working for the bad guys again. And the thing is, like, okay, I know that this is 10 years before we see him again. But the thing is he grew up as a thief working for some sort of crime syndicate run by Lady Proxima. One of my favorite parts of the movie is kind of easy to miss if you're not paying attention, and also if maybe you don't understand like music theory. But when he is running away at the beginning of the movie and he decides to join the Empire just to get off world real quick, there is that, like, join the Empire propaganda ad, and it is playing the Imperial March, but in a major key. And this has led to a lot of theories among the fandom that the Imperial March is an actual song in the Star Wars universe, and it is actually the Imperial anthem. But the Imperial anthem is played in a major key. And so, like, when Vader and the Emperor come onto the ship for the first time, that music is actually playing just like you would play Hail to the Chief for the United States President. But the audience is hearing it in a minor key to let us know these people are evil. So that the music that Han hears is what the Imperial troopers would hear when Vader or the Emperor would show up. It is the national anthem, if you were, of the Empire. So that this is what they hear in-universe. And the scary minor key, boom, 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 is what we, the audience, hear to let us know these are the bad guys. And I freaking love that theory. Because it makes so much sense. Like, of course the Empire sees themselves as the good guys. This is their national anthem. Look at us. We're the greatest, you know. And so Han hearing that is not like an Easter egg for the fans to be like, ha ha ha. It's actually what the people in the universe are hearing. It's the propaganda of the Empire. Which I think is the coolest idea ever, and I want them to make that officially canon. Like, screw you, Dave Filoni, and your cartoons. This is what I want to be official canon.
Mm.
Because to me, that makes so much more sense than Darth Maul somehow survived. Mm. But That to me is a thing I love. But the thing about the beginning of, like, I like the beginning of all these little rebellions, because that is what Infest Nest says, like, oh, we're a rebellion, and you're supposed to be like, yeah, you know? I want to know what happened in these 10 years to make Han go from, like, screw the Empire, we're the bad guys, and, like, I'm going to help Infest Nest, even though Voss and Crimson Dawn will kill me, because I have a soft spot for this kid who said, my people got their tongues cut out, or whatever. Like, he doesn't know this kid. She could be lying. You know? Mm-hmm. Like, one guy is offering him lots of power and lots of money, and this girl is offering him, like, a blood hunt on his head from one of the most powerful gangs ever. What about the Han Solo we see at the beginning of New Hope, sitting in that bar, negotiating with Jabba, and dealing with Greedo, would make the choices in this movie?
Something happened and he became hard.
But the thing is that everything in his background suggests that he should be hard by the end of this movie.
And he's not. I mean, the closest thing we get is Han shooting first, killing Beckett.
Yeah, now that's a good scene. That's Han Solo. When Chewbacca's like, oh, crap, you just shot his ass.
No debate, like, no. Right when in the middle of his big speech,
Han is like, you are not going to be monologuing. No. We're not doing that.
I feel like I said, I feel like he needed to be a little bit more harder earlier in the movie. And I feel that a lot of that is lost because of Lord and Miller's want of this being more of a comedy.
But the thing is that Han Solo is a comedic character. Han Solo is the screw-up of the Star Wars universe.
He's a scoundrel.
People forget that.
You know, there's that very funny scene in Episode 4 where he's trying to fire against the stormtroopers, and then they walk into a room full of stormtroopers chasing him back.
Yeah, I mean, he's the guy that's like, hi, we're all okay here. How are you? Like, he's not really that slick. He's charismatic. But he's not really that witty and slick. There is the thing, and I wish they would, again, pull crap from the EU and make it canon. The EU established that Han Solo is a force user. He just doesn't know it. And Han Solo's force power is luck. It's why he's a good gambler, and it's why he keeps getting out of situations he should be dead. Han Solo has the force power of luck. Can he control it? No, he cannot. But the force is on his side, which is why he fits in well with the Skywalker clan. And it's why in the EU, when he and Leia have children, their children are massive force users, not because Leia is a Skywalker, it's because Han also has access to the force. And I wish they would bring that in, because the thing is, the movies keep showing that, they just don't understand that's what they're doing.
Throwing it, his luck is the dice. The dice that he gets from Kira that he puts in the Falcon.
Well, he has the dice, and then he gives them to Kira, and then Kira gives them back. Like,
we have two movies where they try to make these dice a thing.
Did you even notice those dice in the Millennium Falcon until they started making them like a, hey, look, this is an Easter egg?
No!
Did anybody notice those dice in the Millennium Falcon until the... No, nobody did, because it was too crap of a, like, 70s 35mm was too crap to notice those freaking dice until they started making them a thing in the new movies. When Leia kept holding those dice, I was like, where'd she get those dice from? Like, what's the deal with the dice? And then they're like, oh, she has the dice from the Millennium Falcon. I'm like, there were dice in the Millennium Falcon? And then there's all these, like, really crappy, like, grainy screenshots from the original movies. And it's like, look, see that little, like, golden smear right there? Apparently, those were dice. Like, okay. It's always fun to have an Easter egg nobody knew about.
Yeah. So that's his luck, were these dice.
I really just wish they'd go ahead and be like, Han Solo had access to the Force, he just can't control it. The Force is with Han Solo, it just does what it wants when it wants. You know?
Yeah.
Because that makes a lot more sense in the context of Star Wars than, you know, some of the other things.
Mm.
But, yeah, the thing is that it makes, like, it makes the character growth in New Hope kind of pointless.
Yeah, he already starts off as the good guy, and then something happens that is never really shown in the movie, that he regresses to kind of being a selfish a-hole, then he becomes the good guy again. Like, why not always have him be the selfish a-hole?
Well, the thing is that I think it would have been a little bit better if you saw that, like, Kira was the one on Corellia that kept trying to make him be a better person. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, he kept saying, like, eh, why should we help these people? And, like, maybe Kira kept giving, like, a portion of their food to people less off than them or whatever.
Or a portion of whatever money they stole to these.
Yeah, and he kept going, like, why do you do that? Like, we earned that, and, you know, like, we need to keep that for us, you know? And she was always, like, his moral conscience or whatever.
Yeah.
And then, like, they get separated, he goes off, he gets, like, mildly brainwashed by the Empire, and then he ends up with Tobias and his gang and everything, and then he finds Kira again, and she plays on that stuff. And all, and then she betrays him at the end of the movie, and he's like, screw it, I'm never going to trust anybody again. And then he ends up with Jabba. Like, you know, then he, like, shoots Tobias in cold blood, and then he's like, screw it, I heard about some Hutt gangster, you know, we can screw him over and whatever. And Chewie's like, are you sure you want to do that? And he's like, yeah, I'm sure I want to do that. You can't trust anybody. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it ends on kind of a downer moment, but we're at the Han Solo we get when he's like, you know, hey, kid, you know, your stupid religion and whatever. It's the here's a blaster by my side, and I just care about money, and, you know?
And, like, yeah, did we really need to see how Han got his gun? And it's so anticlimactic. Someone gave it to him. Here's a gun. Shoot.
Did we need to see how he got the name Han Solo?
Oh, Han, you're Han. Singular. Han individual.
Yeah.
Like, this movie did not need to happen. I'll be honest. People say that about Rogue One. You know, Rogue One is a pointless movie. Han Solo is a kind of a pointless movie, but they could have done more with this movie than they did. Someone once said that the problems with this movie is that it plays it too safe. And I'm hard-pressed to disagree with that.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I like so many parts of this movie. It sounds like we don't like this movie. And, I mean, I don't know how you feel about it, but I like this movie.
Not terrible.
I really wanted to talk about this movie.
I get it. Is this movie, does this movie need to exist? No, but did I have fun watching it? Absolutely.
But the thing is that I needed it to be tweaked. And I don't know whose fault it is. I mean, I say fault, but I wanted it to go a little more in depth. I feel like it's a little too shallow.
That's what I meant by playing it safe. It never really goes as deep as it could go.
Yeah.
Because this is a Han Solo movie. He needs to be likable. But we lose that scoundrelness. We lose that nihilism. We lose that Star Wars equivalent of an atheist.
Did you ever feel like Han Solo in episode 4 was unlikable? I mean, he's a scoundrel.
Very selfish, and that was kind of the point. That he's all about himself, he's all about the score, you know, I'm only doing this for the money. That's on Harrison Ford and his charisma.
I will say that one of the good things to come out of this movie is that the novelization of this movie was written by my friend Mer Lafferty.
Ooh.
Love Mer. She is amazing. I adore everything about her. If you've never read any of her books, please go read her books. She's done some tie-ins, but also her original fiction is excellent. I highly recommend everything she's ever done. Go look her up. Right now, her most recent stuff is a series called The Midsolar Murders. So if you like murder mysteries, but you also like things set in space, so like Star Wars, it is, right now there are 2 books in the series, Station Eternity and Chaos Terminal. Station Eternity and Chaos Terminal are the 2 books, and they are murder mysteries set in space, like I said. So if that sounds like a thing that you would like, look those up. That's Mer, M-U-R, Lafferty, L-A-F-F-E-R-T-Y. Highly recommend all of her stuff. She is amazing and good friend of mine. And of course, I highly recommend you go pick up the novelization of Solo, A Star Wars Story as well, if you like tie-in fiction. But yeah, I wanted to shout her out because she is an amazing person and I love her. It has some, she put in some scenes in there that are not in the movie, of course, which happens a lot with tie-in fictions, including a scene that has Saw Gerrera and Jyn Erso. So, see what happens with them.
I will say that, you know, we did get one good thing out of this movie, and that is Millennium Falcon Smuggler's Run at the Disney parks. Because that ride is kind of based off the heist in this movie. What are you doing in that ride? You're driving the Millennium Falcon, picking up train cars full of Calaxium. Which is what they're doing in this movie.
Yeah. Okay, so we haven't talked about one of the big things that they've added to the canon We have to talk about the Kessel Run.
Oh, yeah, yeah, we clearly skipped over that. So, yeah, in the original movie, that's clearly a bluff. He's bluffing. He's BSing. And I like that that was just him BSing.
And also George Lucas not understanding that a parsec is a unit of distance and not a unit of time.
So what they do is they show the Kessel Run, which I don't think they really should have done that in the movie. And it explains, oh, how can he do it in 12 parsecs? Galaxium.
Well,
and a black hole and an octopus monster.
I was going to ask, how do we feel about the story they came up with for it?
I didn't like it. I wish that they had not shown the Kessel Run at all.
I'm kind of with you because, okay, so here's the thing, you know, if you've been in Star Wars fandom for long enough, you know how this went down. It's the ship that did the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs. That's what he says in the original movie. Less than 12. So this is a big fish story that keeps getting bigger fish over the years. By the time he meets Obi-Wan and Luke, it's less than 12. In this movie, it's 12. By the end of the movie, it's like just under 12. Okay.
And yeah, he says, yeah, we did it. Kessel Run, less than, in 12 parsecs. And Chewie's like, really? Well, it's 12 if you round down.
Yeah, yeah. It was just a little over 12. And then he says 12. And by the time he meets Luke and Obi-Wan, it's less than 12. Yeah. So Han's really stretching that. The thing is, though, is that in this movie, in episode 4, like I said, it happens because George Lucas did not understand that a parsec was not a unit of time. It is a unit of measurement. It is a unit of length, specifically. So a parsec is distance. It is not time. It sounds like it should be second, but it's not. It's distance. It's like a mile. And so the Kessel Run in this becomes you have to go through a very specific tunnel to avoid your ship being busted by this weird cloud full of debris and space squids and a gravity well and whatever. Because that is the safe path that has been charted. And it takes
20, I believe, that they did
20 parsecs or something in the, I forget exactly how much. Okay. So it takes a certain number of parsecs, a certain distance that you have to go through this safe tunnel, and it takes a certain amount of time and a certain amount of distance. Well, thanks to enslaving L3 in the computer, they end up charting a better course between L3's computer and a little bit of luck and the fact that they've got unrefined fuel in the Falcon. So it's basically a trick nobody will technically be able to repeat.
Because the circumstances will never be duplicated.
Yeah, it was absolutely just a weird set of circumstances. They had the best nav computer. They had the correct fuel, which nobody would dare take with them because it's not refined and it was about to explode. And it also, you have to go near a gravity well and you run the risk of getting sucked in. And yeah.
And we get the explanation that the Falcon is shaped that way because they jettisoned the escape pod.
Yeah, that too. So the Falcon doesn't have any escape pods anymore. If something happens while you're on the Falcon, you are screwed. I don't know why they never replaced the escape pod, but whatever. Maybe they like the aesthetics. I think that, one, they sacrificed a space squid. Two, they sacrificed L3. How many creatures have to die for this fuel, you absolute monsters? Am I the only one thinking that?
Yeah, I mean, I get ya.
I mean, Space Squid wasn't doing nothing. It was just chilling, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They came into its domain. It didn't go after them. Why did Space Squid have to die? And that looked like a very painful death.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a lingering, awful death. My heart goes out to Space Squid. Poor thing. It didn't do nothing. But, yeah, I agree with you. I kind of wish they hadn't gone there.
Yeah, I mean, it feels this movie was written, and I don't know if it was or wasn't, but it feels like it was written by bullet points. We need to explain the gun. We need to explain how Han and Chewie met. We need to explain the Falcon. We need to explain the Kessel Run. And we need to explain these dice.
I don't know why everybody is so into the dice.
I don't know.
It's so weird.
So, does this movie have the magic? I don't think this movie needs to exist, but I had fun watching it even again, the first time and this time. This has magic. I just don't think the movie needs to exist.
Okay, I'm going to tell you why I think it has the magic. And it's really down to two things. Mm-hmm. One, Donald Glover is Lando.
Yes.
This entire movie gets a pass from me because Donald Glover as Lando is just the best. Him and those capes.
An entire closet of capes.
You can never have too many capes. My closet is also filled with capes. I have way too many capes, maybe. And none of them are as flash as Lando's. I really want his cape collection. If anybody can help me out with that, please send your capes to P.O. Box. No. I'm serious. If anybody would send me capes, I would go get a P.O. Box right now. I love capes. Lando has good capes. And Donald Glover is a perfect Lando for this film. Love it. I also love that that in the Sabacc game, Lando cheats and then Han takes away that cheating and wins the Falcon fair and square. Han does not steal the Sabacc card to cheat himself. He just takes away Lando's ability to cheat. And I do respect that.
Win. Yeah. I like how he said, if you had this card, you would win, and kind of tosses the card out.
And then he says fair and square.
Yeah, fair and square.
And I respect that. He doesn't use the card to cheat Lando back. He just takes away his ability to cheat.
I do love he has that little almost. Okay. It's a reference that I know was not intentional. But of course, the character of Miles Morales was loosely based on Donald Glover. Donald Glover did in fact voice Miles Morales in one of the cartoons. And the way he summons the card is the web shooter motion.
Yeah. Also, he plays Miles Morales' uncle
in the MCU.
But yeah, so this movie would automatically get a pass if the only thing it had in it was Donald Glover's Lando and his wonderful, wonderful capes. It also gets a pass for me because I love L3, even though they did her so dirty, dirty.
Oh, yeah, they did.
I mean, L3 is a great concept done absolutely just the dirtiest. So even though I hate what they did to her, I love the concept. I love L3. I will always love L3. L3 forever. I wish L3 and B2 could get together and, you know, just wreck shit.
Yeah.
So that's why it has the magic for me, those two things. Everything else I kind of question, but those two things, awesome.
So, yeah, again, I had fun watching this again. Definitely has the magic for me. So let's move on to next week. Kiki, there's a new Planet of the Apes movie coming out real soon. It actually looks pretty good, and I can't wait to see it. So in honor of that, we are going all the way back to the original 1968 Planet of the Apes. Get your paws off me, you damn dirty ape.
Dr. Zaius.
Yes, we're going to go back and talk Dr. Zaius. We're going to talk about the original Planet of the Apes. Come back for that, and we will talk to you all next time. Bye!
Don't let the magic stop here. Join our conversations on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at Rewatching the Magic. We are on the X, formerly known as Twitter, at Rewatch the Magic. And new episodes are available every week at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com. Remember, the magic is for everyone. It only stops if you let it.
Podcasts are fun.
But there's work to be done.
We encourage you to get involved. Here are some organizations we support.
The American Civil Liberties Union fights for the constitutional rights of all Americans. Find them at ACLU.org.
The National Network of Abortion Funds helps people find access to safe abortion services. Their site is abortionfunds.org.
The Trevor Project provides a 24/7 crisis helpline for LGBTQ youth and education services for schools on LGBTQ issues. They can be found at thetrevorproject.org.
Or find a way to help in your area.